Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Award-winning author Yann Martel's latest is The High Mountains of Portugal. He's in town to read from it, but we've got him on the phone to discuss it further. And first of all, thanks for joining us, Yann.
It's my pleasure.
So I have to ask, I know that you're a widely read or widely kind of interested reader based on, you know, your suggestions to our former prime minister. I was trying to remember if you ever recommended anything by José Saramago when you were making those recommendations.
No, you know what? Despite the fact that I sent him 101 books, which seems like a lot, it's as you would know, it's a drop in the bucket. There's so many wonderful books out there. So I never got to Saramago. Mm. But had I decided to go further, I would no doubt have sent, Blindness or All the Names.
Mm-hmm. And I was curious about kind of your own history with Saramago, not just because this is set in Portugal, but I feel there's some sort of like affinity in terms of just this like hyper surreality that the two of you sort of trade in, at least in this book and in a lot of his works.
I would say coincidental. I mean, I have read Saramago, but it wasn't a conscious influence. I chose my very first novel that I ever worked on in my early 20s was set in Portugal. The novel I meant to work on when I went to India was one set in Portugal, as I stated in the author's note of Life of Pi. Portugal was the first country I explored on my own backpacking. So it's a country that has sort of marked me because it was the first time I was on my own, just a lone element, bathing in this beautiful European country. So it stayed with me. And then there's other reasons too. Trashos Montes. There's a province called Trashos Montes, which means beyond the hills or behind the hills. And I thought it was an odd name to call a region. And I realized that the naming of regions is the beginning of storytelling, hence the high mountains of Portugal, which do not exist. So Saramago nourished me, but I wouldn't say that I consciously set the novel in Portugal because of him.
Right. So then, okay, you traveled in Portugal that, you know, initially you tried to write a novel and then you've returned to that country within the context of this novel. What was it about the timing or the story that worked this time that maybe didn't work in that first
go? Who knows? I guess I've matured as a person. I guess I've matured as an author. I had certain ideas things clicked and fell into place. It is a mystery why twice I tried to write it and I couldn't, and this time I managed to. If I knew the ins and outs of artistic creation, I'd be pumping out novels every novel every year, and I would have figured out the formula. I haven't. I don't know why it suddenly started to work. A certain number of serendipitous events. You know, one of them was rereading some Agatha Christie's. Just suddenly things fell into place. I can't. You know, it doesn't sound like a very intelligent answer, but it finally came together.
So, if you do have difficulty kind of like pumping these out, like, you know, like you're a Stephen King or something, how do you know like when the tumblers lock into place and that you've got the story then? Like what is it that...
Well, when you're a writer, you're your first reader. And as you're writing, you like what you're reading. Your first reader yourself is delighted. And of course, sometimes you're deluded, you're wrong, but sometimes you're onto something. So, and that's something that I think every writer learns along the way. They learn what works not only for them, but through them for others. And sometimes they're right, and I was lucky with Life of Pi. This quirky tale that I told basically only for myself resonated with a lot of other people. And sometimes people tell you didn't quite get it quite so right. As some people might say, I didn't quite get it quite so right with Beatrice and Virgil, my subsequent novel, which was an allegorical take on the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. It certainly worked for me, but others had reservations. So it's a bit of a mystery, but clearly the first person who has to be pleased is the author himself.
Right. So then the story, I mean, it's three stories kind of with obviously some threads that link them. Did it all come together in one idea, or did you have kind of disparate ideas that you were able to kind of interweave eventually? Like, what was the kind of process?
I had disparate ideas because I had disparate things to say. Unlike Life of Pi or Beatrice and Virgil, where one might think I had sort of one central point to make. Life of Pi was, I have two stories based on the same set of facts. Which story do you choose? Beatrice and Virgil, I asked, why do we represent the Holocaust always in the same way? Why don't we, deploy the full tools of fiction on the Holocaust? This one, it was a more, I had a more disparate point. I was more talking about states of relationship. How do we stand in relationship to things that we believe in or things that we don't believe in? So this one, I think, would be characterized, as people have pointed out by the fact that it's in three stories, is more characterized by diversity than unity, I would say.
In terms of the creation of each of those stories, like, obviously there's, you know, a linear thread throughout history, right? Like the earliest in historical setting is first, and then we move to kind of closer to the present day. But I'm curious, did you write them in that order, or like?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. It's funny. I don't know. I'm one of these strange people, but when I write a book, I start with page one and I end with the last page. And I developed them. I mean, first of all, I planned very carefully. I'm not one of these writers who just starts writing, not knowing where he's going. To me, it's like building a building. You have, you know, the architect has to know what the function of the building is before he can draw the plan. Form must follow function. So I have to. I think it through, and then I start mapping it out, because presumably what happens in the beginning will affect what happens in the middle and the end. So despite the fact that it's in three separate sections, I was well aware of what was happening in part three when I was writing part one, because after all, you're supposed to read the thing and hopefully, you know, the reader finishes reading the book and thinks about it, and therefore there has to be a certain unity, at least a thematic unity. And so I work hard on that. But when it actually comes to writing, yeah, I do start at the beginning and I finish at the end.
Right, which isn't necessarily always the case, as I've found with talking to authors. You mentioned that it's like an architect, right, that you're looking at form and function. Are you, when it comes to kind of building a structure, you know, I mean, there's obviously like kind of how it looks on the exterior, but there's, you know, the foundation and the framing of particular rooms and stuff like that. How much work are you doing on, you know, making sure that those things work to build the story atop of, right? Like, I mean, because there's kind of like the cosmetics that everyone sees, but there's kind of the mechanics underneath that
hold it together. Oh, I work a lot on that. In fact, to me, that is more the construction of the novel than anything else. I don't want to use a cliche, but I will, but it's sort of like, you know, the proverbial iceberg, nine-tenths unseen. In a novel, certainly, I'm not going to generalize, but in my experience, nine-tenths of the work is unseen. It's very much, a novel to me is very much an artifice. It's a construct. It's a form. And so you have to think very carefully about what goes into it if you want to try to gauge what its effect will be. So much of it, I mean, as much as I think it through, of course, there's also a portion that's left as spontaneous. There has to be a degree of spontaneity of just you do things because that's the way who you are. That's what's wonderful about art, of course. It's such a personal expression of one's individuality. And yet, for being so personal, nonetheless, when they're good, when great novels are written, they connect with so many people. Despite the intense individuality of its creation, it's amazing how the individual then tends to reflect the universal. That's one of the magical mysteries of art.
Mm. The details in the novel, in terms of, you know, say, like the first section, homeless, you know, the stuff around early cars and how to operate early cars and things like that, like, how much research do you do to kind of create veracity for these things?
I do a lot, in part because I find it interesting. I mean, I'm not particularly interested in automobiles, but it was interesting going to this motoring museum in the south of England, and I went there because my partner is English, and every year we go to England, and so I visited this motoring museum, the National Motoring Museum in Bewley in the south of England, where they had a 1904 Renault, and so I asked permission. I got permission to sort of enter the car, sit on it, look underneath it, open up the hood. I also did lots of research on chimpanzees. They're a very well-studied species, so I did see a few live ones at a sanctuary, but I didn't really need that as much as what I got from books, because there's been lots written about chimpanzees. But I did research on that, on pathology. I saw two autopsies on Portugal, of course. I went twice to Portugal. I drove the route that Tomás in Part 1 drives. I did all those things because you, in a good story, you want a degree of verisimilitude, that it feels like reality so that it gives it more weight. I mean, sometimes you want a more fable-like effect, perhaps, but In this case, with my stories, I find that the fiction really works best if it's built upon what looks like nonfiction.
Right. I was going to say that, like, you're able to kind of sell some of the stranger things by nailing the ones that seem very real, right? Like, you ground it in some way so that when you take off a little, people are still with you.
Yeah, well, in a book, in a story, you do to some extent want to, in the reader, elicit a factor of recognition. Now, not too much, otherwise it's boring. Mm-hmm. Why read a novel in which everything is familiar to you? But amidst the familiar, you know, amidst the strange new sights, you want some of the familiar ones so that the reader can root himself, herself, in a noble reality, but then take that reader somewhere new.
You mentioned the Agatha Christie books, that you happen to be rereading some Agatha Christie. Obviously, very central to the second section, without going into, like, too much why, I don't want to, like, spoil the surprise. But the theories that that Eusebio's wife espouses, I'm curious, like, did you come up with those as you were reading the Agatha Christie, or, like, did you have...
Yeah, no, I came up with those. So I delighted in writing that section. The character there, the wife of the pathologist, comes to seem to point out the startling similarities between the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie and the Gospels, how in many, many ways they are documents that operate in the same way with the same kinds of characters. So, for example, the role of the witness is key to a murder mystery. So is the role of the witness in the Gospels in the Gospels of the New Testament. Neither Hercule Poirot nor Jesus cared to write anything, so everything had to be the result of the testimony of others. And just as in a murder mystery, the witnesses don't all say the same thing in the Gospels. The four Gospels don't communicate the same reality. They are not only differences, they are discrepancies. They are things that are contradictory. Also, it's interesting how this, the novels of Agatha Christie, of course, are fictions. Well, it's interesting how the Gospels are allegories. They are written, 30, 40, 50 years after the death of Jesus of Nazareth, and they are written in highly symbolic language. These are not accounts of journalists. These are allegories. How strange that Western civilization was changed not by a factual telling, but by a fictional one. But to get back to Agatha Christie, it strikes me, one of the most obvious ways to look at the Passion of Jesus, the story of Jesus, the Jesus event, as academics will call it, is to call it a murder mystery with two capital M's. There's a lot of similarities. I don't want to reveal too much, but mm-hmm. It's startling if you start looking at how an Agatha Christie novel operates, not only in how it's told, but how it's received by the reader, and you compare that with how the Gospels were composed, and you see a startling number of similarities. And I think there's a reason for that. I think it's that both Agatha Christie and Jesus made death palatable, one by being insanely entertaining, and the other by resurrecting. But in both cases, that fearsome phenomenon that we're all scared of was suddenly made more palatable, more approachable. Hence why Agatha Christie remains to this day the world's most popular writer, and why Jesus changed the course of Western civilization. Until then, in religion, you never had the cases of gods dying, or resurrecting. But suddenly that made death not a finality, but a threshold, and therefore less threatening. And the same thing with Agatha Christie. She makes death less threatening by being so entertaining about it, and yet without being glib or nihilistic. There's no nihilism in Agatha Christie. There is a sincere quest to find the murderer because murder is bad.
The notion that, Poirot and the settings of Agatha Christie kind of circle towards Jerusalem. I'm curious, did you pick up on that in reading it, or had there been like a theory out there about this? Or?
No, I just picked it out. Yeah, there's an appointment with death which takes place in Petra, but starts in Jerusalem, and there's murder in Mesopotamia, which of course is very close to the Holy Land. Mm-hmm. Agatha Christie, of course, traveled with her archaeologist husband, and hence the worldly setting of some of her murder mysteries. But as I said, the coincidence is, the one that I discuss in the novel is Murder on the Orient Express. There are 13 characters. Well, who? Jesus and his band were a group of 13. There was a traitor among 13 on Murder on the Orient Express. There's, of course, a traitor among the band of travelers traveling with Jesus. Another thing that was interesting to point out is how quickly we all know who the victim is in an Agatha Christie murder, but we always forget who the murderer was. It's amazing how you read the whole book to find out who that person is, and once you do, you instantly forget it. Well, it's the same thing in how we receive the Gospels. We all know who the victim was. We all know it was Jesus of Nazareth. Even people who know nothing about Christianity and care nothing for it know that Jesus was a victim, was murdered, was crucified. And yet people never think, never consider, never seem to remember who was the victimizer, who killed Jesus. Why is it not, you know, just as everyone knows that Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK, the name of the murderer usually stays with us. Why is it that with the key murder of Western civilization, we don't seem to have a name on our lips to who did it? Why is that? And same thing with the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie. We always seem to forget who did it. So as I said, there's many, many similarities and echoes. It's quite a fascinating thing I found. That was, as I said, a very interesting section to write.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, so Eusebio himself is a pathologist, and so in some ways he's the detective in another murder mystery in terms of, you know, solving
yes,
how people died. Was it kind of an obvious kind of linkage to have his wife espouse these views in a section where, like, you know, the protagonist is also an investigator?
Well, in this novel, I was interested in looking at what people do with suffering, and I was particularly looking at it in relation to how much people have faith in religion. Because the interesting thing about faith is, aside from the fact that it's a very strange phenomenon in our age where we're so encouraged to be reasonable, and, you know, to be unreasonable is pejorative, is negative, yet people continue to have faith, continue to believe in gods. And considering we've had modernity triumphing for 300-400 years, how peculiar is that? How can people still believe in gods, considering the triumph of vaccination, of man on the moon, of computers, of phones, which fly in the face of religion? How do people continue to have faith? I was interested in that. And one of the things and I say this whether people care about religion or not, one thing that's interesting about faith is its capacity, about religious faith particularly, is its capacity to deal with evil and with suffering. That's the great feature of religious faith, is that it puts evil in a greater context, of which any secular dogma is incapable of doing. In a purely materialist reading of reality, suffering is just inexplicable. Your child was run over by a drunk driver. That's it. You can maybe explain how the child died and the reasons of the driver's toxicity, how alcohol operates on the system, but that obviously misses the point entirely. The actual meaning of suffering is inexplicable in secular interpretations of life. What's fascinating about the religious interpretation, and I say this whether people believe it or not, it's not a question of whether it's true or not, it's a question of just this is what it does. What's interesting about religious faith is that it takes suffering and puts it in a greater context. It still hurts, of course. No one says that religion just gets rid of suffering, but it puts it in a greater context, and that's one of its great qualities. So in this novel, I was interested in looking at how do people deal with their suffering? What are the tools that they have? So in part one, I posited a man who has no faith. Mm-hmm. In part two, I posited a man who has faith, but it's tested. His faith is in something, some long-ago event that is much discussed, but, you know, there's little current relevancy. But he has faith. Well, how does his faith bear up when he's tested? Hence his wife, who is trying to bring him comfort, and why she makes this linkage between this distant religious event and this current author. That part of it all takes place in 1938, when Agatha Christie was a woman, you know, in her 40s. She creates this linkage to try to make it more relevant. And then in part three, I have someone who, in a sense, he has faith, but it's unnecessary because he's living with the faith object itself. He's living in a state of grace. In each case, I wanted to look to have a different tone to it. So in part three, in part two, I wanted the faith to be heartfelt, but most tenuous, most tested. Hence the murder, hence the rootedness in the body. Because after all, religion only makes sense in terms of death. The purpose of religion is because we die. And religion is rooted in the rotting of the body. So I wanted to have an actual full-on autopsy. In a sense, to remind the reader, you can deny death as much as you want, but this is coming your way. This is what wet gangrene does to a body. That being so, are you sure that there's nothing out there? Are you sure that you fully understood reality and there's nothing beyond but this material reality? Is that you're really willing to go, bleakly you're willing to go gently into that good night? So that explains each of the different tones of each of the sections.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I found interesting in terms of, like, just examining storytelling and these parallels, you talk about, you know, the case report that he gets with attached to a body being like the dust jacket on a book, right? Like that the description hints at but doesn't always, you know, line up with what the actual book is. And I was curious about, had you read some case reports and just kind of drawn that parallel yourself, or did you have something kind of deeper you wanted to say about like dust jackets for your books? Or,
well, that is true, that you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, to use a gross cliche. That and the same thing with the body. The you know, a good diagnostician can tell the cause of a death, but you really need the pathologist to go in there and open up the book of the body and read every chapter to finally find the black culprit who did it. And so sometimes the clinical report isn't enough, is misleading, just as sometimes you read dust jackets, and that's a sort of a coy, you know, publishing illusion there.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, sometimes dust jackets don't really render the reality. Sometimes in a misleading way, but sometimes just because the book is too... In fact, I find it quite hard to summarize mine. Life of Pi was very easy to summarize, Boy in a Lifeboat with a Tiger. You know, it was very easy to summarize factually, but even thematically, you know, two stories, one set of facts, which do you choose? This one is a more ambiguous one to summarize, hence my suspicion of any sort of clinical report on it.
Right. You mentioned that the first section, that it's a man without faith. Tomas, I mean, it's a fascinating character because you introduce him, you know, walking backwards and, you know, basically like showing his head to God. And I understand in terms of like he's lost his faith because of what's happened in his personal life. But at the same time, I mean, it could be argued that he has faith. It's just directed in a different place in terms of this search for this religious item, right? That like he puts faith in this, the existence of this, that he's on the right track, that it's a voyage of faith.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that, but I think it's essentially motivated by a negative feeling. As he says when he gets to this object, well, I don't want to reveal too much,
yeah,
but I think his quest is essentially negative. He wants to destruct, not to construct. And I suppose it still implies some sort of dialogue with the hereafter, with a greater reality. But it is essentially negative, and that only goes so far, as he himself discovers. And I think that's true in life, that you go on a path of destruction, you are eventually left with nothing. That's the easiest thing to do, in fact, and this is another literary illusion, I suppose. It's very easy to criticize. It's much more difficult to create. So it's you know, it's a lesson I learned myself in life, and I think of Tomas's quest as being essentially negative. But, you know, I don't want to box in people's reactions.
I suppose he's looking for
which way they want,
for a creation that criticizes in some ways.
Mm.
One of the kind of comments I've heard about that first section is that there's kind of like the driving thing to reads to some as slapstick. And I certainly didn't interpret that. I, you know, looked at it as this difficulty adapting to modernity, right? That like his trouble with driving isn't like to be like a goofy sort of situation that he presents to the world. It's that he's struggling through. This is like a rite of passage, or like, you know, level.
I mean, that was my commentary in the modern world. I think we are overwhelmed by technology. We think we navigate it coolly, but in fact, I think it. It strikes me as remarkable how every time a new gadget is invented, it's supposed to simplify our lives. It's supposed to give us more time. We seem to have less time the more gadgets we have. I think we are overwhelmed by technology. I think it has in many ways alienated us from... I mean, the great piece of technology called the Great City alienates us from the Earth, from the Earth that our ancestors walked upon and hunted in. But even smaller bits of technology, whether it's cell phones and these other devices, I think, while being convenient, are also alienating. And we tend to forget that. They tend to be means, but we tend to forget what the ends are. So I think we live awash in this technology, and I think it has led to muddied waters. I think we are far more confused about the purpose of the technology than we used to be, when technology was much simpler.
Yeah, I found it an interesting parallel to Peter, the sort of central character of the final third, that, you know, like he essentially eschews modernity, right? Like that he retreats to the past.
Yes, that section, in a sense, in time seems, even though it's the most modern one, has the most ancient feel. He doesn't live with electricity. He has running water, but it's only cold water. He has no watch. He has no phone at in his apartment. Yeah, he lives to me the simplest, deepest life. He lives in a state of grace. And, you know, he does have some technology. He has an automobile. There is running water. But it's really, it's very marginal on his life. It's not central to who he is.
Right. That, you know, Tomás's story is one of, you know, struggling to adapt, and whereas Peter seems to be, you know, accepting rejection in some way, that he just, you know, is like, I'm not going to adapt. I'm going to actually kind of retreat to this and find peace in it in some way.
Yeah. That novel to me was sort of like a description of a Buddhist monk meditating on a mountaintop. It was that sort of feel that I was exploring.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously it deals a great deal with faith. Was there any thought about the fact that, you know, there's three stories and, you know, obviously there's the Trinity. Was there any thought to that?
Well, you know, the obvious answer would be I could say, oh, yes, of course. But honestly, the novel very clearly broke into those three naturally, narratively. Mm. But you're right, three is a very Christian. But, you know, there's no great... Part two is, in a sense, divided into two parts. There's two different women.
Right.
So it just fell into three. In part because there's sort of three colorations of faith. There's, you know, there's atheism, agnosticism, and theism. There's kind of three takes one might take on divine reality. You can completely deny it. You can be ambivalent about it or ambiguous about it, and then you can believe in it. So the fact that there's the three kinds of positions dictated that there be three parts, it also happens to be a nicely Christian number.
So then now that you've resolved that the Portugal story that, you know, you were first working on, or at least you've written a story in Portugal, is there another place you've yet to resolve that you need to write about?
Well, it's funny, just very recently, while I was in Amsterdam for the Dutch launch of the High Mountains of Portugal, I suddenly had another idea for a novel, and I nearly regret it in the sense that it's too soon. I want to take a bit of a break, but I've been reading the Iliad by Homer, and I suddenly had this novel for an idea for a novel starting during the Trojan War, and it would jump closer to time to us. But it's quite exciting. A novel is set in its starting point anyway during the Trojan War, and I've been actually dreaming about it. It's been quite forceful, so. Yeah, I do have another novel in mind. It's still very early. It may still just turn out to be an anecdote and it'll just die. But so far it's been quite exciting, and I've been sort of trying to think about the kind of research that I would do, the books that I would read, and how I would approach writing it.
Well, for now we have The High Mountains of Portugal. Jan, thank you very much for taking some time to talk about the book.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.